All right, you guys, welcome back. Hard Rock Radio Live, where the music doesn't suck. I'm your host today, DJ Lovely Laura. Well, the long-awaited interview has finally come. I know all of you have been waiting out there, tuned in, and in the chat room, so thanks for sticking around. I have a very special guest with me today. He's the legendary bass player and was a member of the 80s LA music scene, playing in several iconic rock bands like Wasp, Steeler, Sin, Thunderball, and Surgical Steel, just to name a few. I'm talking about the legendary Rick Fox. So he's joined us right now. So, hey, Rick, how are you doing? And thank you for coming on the show today.
I'm doing great. I hope you are, too. And I hope everybody who's listening in is doing great.
Well, we are doing fantastic. I am just so excited to have you on the show today. So much history behind the music and stuff with you, and so many things that you've been doing. I respect you as a musician. I admire you as a person. Let's go back to the early years, Rick. I know you did some photography. You were out of New York, and you became personal friends with the rock band Kiss. So let's get started somewhere around there.
Okay. I was dating one of Peter Criss's sisters, and this is before he was in Kiss. So the family used to live around the corner from me in Brooklyn, and in high school I was into photography, so I had full access of the photo lab. I had all the film and chemicals I could get my hands on, so I was like a picture-taken fool. And when Peter answered the ad and got the gig in Kiss, and this is before Ace Frehley was in the band, he used to come stop by his mom's house, which is, as I said, around the corner from where I lived, and he used to pick us all up, the rest of the family, the kids, you know, my friend John Alton, Anne Marie Hughes, you know, Peter's younger sisters, and we'd all go into Manhattan to the loft on 23rd Street, and we'd watch them rehearse. So essentially, I was watching history unfold right before my own eyes.
Wow, that's amazing.
And one day we went up there, and there was this guy in a gray pinstripe suit with an orange sneaker and a purple sneaker leaning against the wall.
Uh-huh.
These Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck licks, and that was Ace Frehley.
Oh, wow.
He was in the band, yeah. So, you know, I took pictures of him at their press event, which was at the late Fillmore East. And those pictures are, like, legendary. They're all over the place now. But, that's kind of like where it started. You know, I used to go to the clubs, and I met the New York Dolls. I hung out with them. You know, the Ramones. I got into, eventually, as I got out of high school, I got right into the Max's Kansas City music rock scene. So I was rubbing shoulders and hobnobbing with all these people who eventually became legends of their own, you know.
All right, so after you were in New York, so you moved to L.A., what was going on when you decided to move out to L.A.?
Well, I had about a year or two prior to that, I was playing six nights a week with a cover band. We were doing, like, top 40, hard rock, heavy metal, whatever was popular. I'd say from Joe Jackson to Judas Priest was a band called the E. Walker Band, and we were like a medium range, you know, we weren't as big as Twisted Sister, all playing the same clubs. We were like a step down from that, but I added such a drastic over-the-top rock image to the band, it really pumped up their following again, and we were playing all, you know, really huge clubs. I was doing that six nights a week. About a year down the road after that, I switched over to a guitar player, a friend of mine I got introduced to, who was, he was featured on Mike Varney's U.S. Metal album series. He was discovered by Mike Varney, Dave Ferrara, and we put a band together based off of his song that was on that album series called Aggressor. So again, we went back into the clubs, I was playing the clubs, and at that time I was in Manhattan also doing a day job working at a clothing store in the Village. And some guys walked in from L.A., and they said they were there to see Twisted Sister. And I said, well, I'm friends with Twisted Sister. I knew the guys in Kiss, and they got excited. And they said, are you in a band? And I said, yeah, I'm playing in a band right now. And they said, well, we know a band in Los Angeles that you would fit in perfect.
Wow.
You can give us just something we can take back there. And I pulled a picture out of my bag of me with the E. Walker Band, a live shot, and I gave it to them. 2 weeks later, I started getting phone calls from Blackie Lawless.
Wow. So he called you personally.
That developed. Blackie sent me a demo tape with some of his material on it. And there's also a misnomer, a rumor going around that people are saying that I said or claimed that I was in the band Americade, which is not true.
Okay.
I said I auditioned for Americade with my friend Walt Woodward III, who passed away not too long ago. and he came to L.A. after me and eventually played in Shark Island and then Scream. But Walt was in a cover band called Rachel, and Arby and Aggressor and Rachel used to do shows at the same clubs together. We were really good friends, you know, really good buddies. So we both went and auditioned for Americade, and Walt got the gig. But I never said I was in Americade, so let me squash that one.
All right.
So anyway, I fly to L.A. Blackie paid for it. I fly to L.A., and he was very, like, how tall are you? He was very adamant on the height thing. And when I got off the plane, I could see why, because him and Randy were the two heads I saw over standing over everyone else's heads as I came out of the plane. Now, I'm wearing boots, and I'm just about, in this, matching his height, so.
Right.
Anyway, about a day or two later, we go into the Randy studio, Magnum Opus, in Buena Park, and I finally watched them go through the set just without me, just the three of them, Randy, Tony, and Blackie. And it took me back, I had a recall moment, where it took me back to the loft where I was watching Kiss. And I felt such a power in the thunder of the music of Wasp, of what became Wasp. They were called Sister then.
Right.
And Blackie finally says, okay, you heard the songs, come on up and try out. And they showed me the songs, and I played, and obviously I passed the audition. I got the gig. We recorded a three-track live master demo, which is infamously out there and pirated all over the world now. And I was with them for about four and a half months, maybe. And during that time is when I came up with the name Wasp.
Right. Tell us that story, because a lot of people, there's a lot of controversy about that story. So,
all right. I know I've said this so many times, but it's really bears repeating. Let me paint the picture for you. We're in Blackie's little house, and let's see. He's watching the Yankees game, sitting there slumped down in a chair with his face on his chin. And the phone rings. I'm talking to somebody from New York, and he has a really long landline. So I'm walking around in the courtyard under the avocado tree. And as I'm talking on the phone, I see this yellow and black thing moving under a leaf, and I quick step on it. Instinctive. I turn the leaf over, and it's a dying hornet.
Yeah?
It was curled up in the position, if anybody remembers the old Green Hornet TV series in the 60s that ran opposite Batman, the image was a hornet curled up coming at you with a stinger.
Right.
Now, this thing was dying, and it was wiggling its tail, so that's the image that I saw. And when it came to me, I went back in the house and I went, I got an idea for the band name. He looks up at me, goes, what? And I said, Wasp.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the old Green Hornet logo. I said, I just killed one out in the yard under a leaf. He looked around aimlessly, like he was thinking about it. He looks back at me and Blackie goes, that's a great band name. He goes, keep thinking like that. That's a great idea. To rehearsal that night, Blackie goes, we got a name for the band. And Brandy says, well, I want to call it Hellion because that's what they call little bad kids in Texas, where I'm from. And I said, Randy, there already is a band in L.A. called Hellion. And they said, well, what are we going to call it? Blackie says, Wasp. Tony, immediately says, who names a band after a bug? I said, Beatles? And that was right there. That was the moment. I said, Scorpions? Blackie said, it's Wasp. That's our new name. That's what we're going to be. And that's history. That's the rest of it. I'm curious to know what they would have called the band if I didn't come up with that. There's an interesting...
Yeah. And how are you not able to keep that name title? How was Blackie able to take that away from you like that?
Well, he came up to me one day. Without warning, he wasn't talking to me for a couple of days. I was getting like the cold dismissal thing, and then he comes up to me and says, listen, we got to talk. I never saw it coming. There was no warning whatsoever. He just said, look, it's not working out, and we're going to have to let you go. So you can either go back to New York and we'll pay you away, or you can stay in L.A. where there's a better opportunity. But one thing I want to say right now, he's very adamant on this, you are not to own any proof that you were in the band. You are not to possess any of the photos. You should give me back the demo tape.
Oh, my God.
And I, for a while, I went out with the negatives. I went up to Sunset Boulevard, and I got some pictures printed, excuse me. And it's a good thing I did. And when I came back to the house, he saw that I had them, and he was furious. He was livid. He was yelling at me like a father yelling at a kid, and he goes, give me back that. You don't own that. That's not your property, even though I was in the pictures.
Right.
Luckily, I stashed a few away, which, as the internet. Don Atkins Jr. took those pictures, and he was Motley Crue's first photographer, so, you know, he gets the photo credit on that, and he took those pictures. I stashed a few away, and I kept the tape. I left the band, obviously, and then what he did was he changed it by putting periods, W-A-S-P,
right.
instead of keeping it as, like, the insect. So I didn't have the smarts at the time to know how to trademark or service mark the name, and had I done that, that really would have put salt in the wound. It would have made it real difficult for him.
Yeah, there's even some artwork out there that you did from the original Wasp.
My original artwork when I was doodling around after it, I was trying to imitate what I saw of the dead hornet, the dead wasp on the ground, and that's what I drew. And luckily, I went through my rock files and my suitcases, and I found it. And I've got that out there now. So, you know, when Darren Upton contacted me from the UK, where he was prepping his book, Wasp, Sting, and the Tail, he says, I want to talk to you. I want your part of the story. This is very integral to me as a Wasp fan. I'm putting this book together. And we talked for like 3 hours, and I told him about the picture, which I eventually found, and I think I sent it to him. But unfortunately, he got a couple of little details wrong in my section, so we're working to correct that. And one thing it's done, though, Darren was very, how do I put this? He said, it's a very curious thing about you, Rick, amongst the Wasp fans. He says, there's a line drawn down the center. You have Wasp fans who are Wasp fans from the very beginning up until Crimson Idol.
Right.
And there's a line in the sand, and then from Crimson Idol on. And the people who are supporting you are the Wasp fans from the beginning up until Crimson Idol. And from the Crimson Idol on, they really don't care. They're more or less Blackie Lawless fans. It doesn't matter who's in the band. It's just that they're a fan of Blackie Lawless. And he says, your name has caused so much controversy amongst the Wasp fan groups. Now that the proof will be out there, things will change. And certainly they have. When I got on Facebook and Darren's book came out, all of a sudden, Wasp fans began to come out of the woodwork and embrace the fact that my validity, yes, you were in Wasp, we now accept it, and we know you came up with the name. So now everybody's looking over at Blackie going, okay, you want to talk about this? And he's not.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you got some diehard fans from that, which paved your way on to the next band, Steeler. Is that what happened after Wasp came about?
Okay, I had to move out of Blackie's house.
Yeah.
And this will be in my book that I'm writing. I became friends with some girls who were, let's just say, escorts. They lived up the street from right next door to Nikki Six.
Okay.
And one of the girls there felt bad and took me in, and I was kind of like the houseboy. You know, I washed the dishes, I vacuumed the carpets, I cleaned the house. Something to kind of earn my keep so that I could stay on the couch.
Right.
And meanwhile, I was trying to audition for bands, and I auditioned for Rat. I auditioned for Greg Leon Invasion, and there was a couple other bands, you know.
Quite right.
I rehearsed a little bit with Hellion when Anne Boleyn was in the band. And then I put an ad out in Music Connection magazine, and I got a call from Ron Keel. He says, I liked your ad. It's the most professional-looking ad I've seen in there, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit more. Come on down and talk to me. So I went to where he was living, and which we came to be known as the Steeler Mansion, which was nothing more than three stores gutted out with no walls between them. And it was the most roach-infested, filthiest place you could ever imagine. And it was, we put it this way, we were the only Caucasian people in the neighborhood.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a bad area of Los Angeles. But it was home for Steeler. Ron told me when I met him that he sacked his lineup. He said, when I came to L.A., I saw that what I had with me is going to be hard to match up to what's already out here. He says, I need to put a band together that's going to be over the top, and I need the most outrageous players I can find. And Mark Edwards was already still in the band at that point. Ron replaced the original drummer with Mark Edwards, so Mark was in there before me. And then Ron gives me a tape, and he says, learn these songs. He says, show me what you can do, and come back, and we'll talk again. I learned the songs. I even put a little bit of my own feel into them. I went back and I played them with Ron, just Ron and I together. He said, that's pretty good. And we got talking about how I knew Kiss, and Ron was a big Kiss fan. And that kind of broke the ice a little bit and leveled the playing field, so to speak. So Mark came back from Texas, and the three of us began rehearsing. And we got really, really tight. And even though I was playing six nights a week previous to that in you know, New York, New Jersey, I wasn't, like, just off the bus as far as a bass player. But I have to credit Mark Edwards with taking the time and the patience to really work with me on working on my timing and listening to what a bass and drummer are really supposed to do when they lock in. And that really helped me a lot with Steeler, you know. And at that point, Ron contacted Mike Varney, who had, from Shrapnel Records, had his Spotlight column in Guitar Magazine. And, you know, Ron says, we need, like, the guitar player from hell. We're coming back out in a big way, and we need somebody that's just, like, over the top. And that's when Varney told us about Yngwie. He played the tape for us. We did a three-way phone conversation, conference, and with talking with Yngwie, and he's, I can't wait to come to America. I can't wait to be in your band, you know, yada, yada, yada. So we flew him over, and he played, and Ron, I have to say, you know, it's Ron and Yngwie butted heads right from day one.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what really shocked me was, you know, here we are, you know, rocking out with Steeler songs, and we, you know, we know the material really strong. Yngwie comes in, hears the songs, and tells Ron to his face, is there anything you can do to make these songs a little bit more interesting? And Ron says, what do you mean? I'm kind of amateurish.
Right.
And Mark and I just kind of turned away and looked at each other, like, here's new guy telling the band leader his songs sound amateur. this is not gonna fly.
Yeah, not at all.
So we began auditioning other guitar players while Yngwie was living with us. And eventually he got the message and said, all right, I'll play your game your way. And we settled down, and we did the songs, and, you know, we recorded the album, and while we were up north at the studio recording, up north in California, the fans found out Yngwie was in town, and there was a club there called the Old Waldorf in San Francisco. They demanded that we break our studio session and come down to San Francisco and play a live show, which we did. And it was the hottest, sweatiest, steaming show we've ever done, I think. And the fans were wild. They were just, like, bouncing off the ceilings.
So wow.
That, we came back. We had the album. And as soon as the album was done, and we had an intro theme that I wrote called, what the heck is it called? I forgot. Abduction. Mark came up with the name, Abduction. We used that as our intro when we opened for A Quiet Riot at Perkins Palace. Gina Zamparelli brought us on, and it was a fortuitous moment. And we got to open for Quiet Riot right at their peak of mental health, was just peaking to number one. So
yeah, that was
outrageous time to be in Steeler.
Oh, yeah. Well, you definitely have some diehard Steeler fans out there. I was definitely a Steeler fan.
They totally rock.
Yeah. So what can you tell us, Rick? Because I know that you guys have been lobbying and people have been asking. They want the Steeler reunion. Is there anything you can tell us about that? Have you been talking to Ron? Have you been talking to Yngwie at all? Do you keep in touch with them?
Well, Ron and I have talked. You know, mm-hmm. Ron contacted me a few years ago before he put out the Steeler Anthology CD. And he said, would you be interested if we ever got the opportunity to do a reunion? I said, anytime, anywhere. Those were my words.
Wow.
He said, that's good to know. He says, if I can get around to when the pieces are in place and we can do a reunion, I'll let you know. And then he reformed Keel. So, you know, I don't know what that says, but I think that Yngwie would not be involved, and I think for obvious reasons. There's just too much between us that have gone on, and I don't think Yngwie would want to look back. He might consider it looking back or moving backwards to do a steel reunion, in my opinion. But Ron has some conditions he'd like to have in place first before we do a reunion, and all I can say is keep your fingers crossed. Pester Ron and say, look, we want a Steeler reunion, we want to see, we want to hear all that stuff from that album. You know, that's what we missed, that's what we heard, and that's what we want to see. So until Ron gives the go-ahead, all we can do is just hope, because it's all in his lap.
All right, guys, you heard it from Rick Fox. We need to demand that Steeler reunion. That's right. All right, so let's go on to the next band, Sin. Tell me a little bit about how you guys originated and who was in this band.
Okay, the name Sin goes back to 1976, 1977, New York, New Jersey. I joined after I was out of the March and Rock band from the Max's Kansas City scene. I wound up being invited to audition for and join a band called Virgin. Now, this predates the Los Angeles Virgin and any other Virgin. They were a big club, glam club band in New Jersey. The lead singer, Ian Chris, he did a Bowie show. He did an Alice show, Alice Cooper. He had a girl that would loan him like an 8-foot python. So we were doing Alice Cooper like to the T. You know, we did Mott the Hoople, Bowie, as I said, all the hard glam bands, all the hard rock, metal, makeup kind of glam stuff we did. Basil Stanley came in on drums, and we had a guy named Vinnie Matthews who went by the name of Keith Stars. He worked with me on the songs. He was the guitar player, and we were playing the club scene. And over time, we changed the name from Virgin to Lust, and then from Lust we went to Sin, and that was around 76, 77. That's where the name was born. I came up with the original artwork for it, which I still have, the name and all of that. And I held on to that so that when I came back into Los Angeles, now we jump ahead to Los Angeles, after Steeler, I was in a better position to kind of call the shots. I was a proven club draw. People liked me. I knew I could pull a crowd into a club. That was good leverage. So I went to the Troubadour and I said, I have a new band. I'd like to, you know, come in here and we're going to headline such and such a night. And the booking agent goes, well, you just don't walk in here and demand a headlining spot. You start out like on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock like everyone else. I said, I just sold out your club like 2 weeks ago. She goes, who are you? I said, I'm Rick Fox. I was the bass player in Steeler. She goes, oh, my God, I am so sorry. Here's Saturday night. She goes, who do you want to open? Who do you want to close?
Wow.
Bang, it was like that, and that's how it started. I was introduced to a keyboard player. I said, I'd like to put a band together with after Steeler. I've got the momentum. We picked virtually unknown guys. Everybody was unknown. I was like the catalyst in the middle. Nobody knew who the keyboard player was. Nobody knew the drummer. Nobody knew the guitar player. Nobody knew the singer. But through word of mouth, we found everybody. We put it together, and they couldn't come up with a name. And you know, the gigs are pending. We can't come up with it. I said, look, I'd like to use my old band name, Sin, from back east. And they couldn't top it. They couldn't come up with anything better. So it's Sin it was. And there was the first L.A. Mach 2 lineup of Sin. And that's where how we became Sin in Los Angeles. And first gigs out, we were filling the house. Our very first show, Motley Crue was there. I think Yngwie Malmsteen was there. David Lee Roth was there. Everybody who was anybody came to that show, and I was I was shocked. I didn't know these people were that interested in seeing what I had to do.
Oh yeah,
we were a proven club draw. Within 6 months, we were playing over in front of thousands of people. But within 6 months, they got a little full of themselves and figured, you know, we don't need Rick anymore. And we were in the middle of recording an album, and they said, you know what? We're going to have to make some changes here. And I walked out of the recording session. I apologized to Bill Metoyer. He was the engineer for Metal Blade. I said, I can't work with this. The egos are too thick in here, and I can't breathe. Wow. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to work. They continued on, became Jaguar, did an album, and sent out 5,000 copies. 3,000 got sent back. Lack of sales. They broke up. I don't know. I then got a call from a guitar player who was living with me in Hoboken, New Jersey, named J.J. Christie. He said, I'm in a band called Alien, and we just broke up. And I know that Kiss is auditioning guitar players, and you're friends with them. Do you think you can put my name on the list? At that point, I had already seen Vinnie Vincent learning the Kiss songs at SIR Studios, because, you know, we would rehearse there. And I said, they already have a guitar player, but I need to put Sin back together. If you want to come out here, this is the time to do it. He says, all right, I'm going to bring my singer and another guitar player with me. I said, all right, fine. They drove across the country through snow, through all kinds of conditions of adversity. They came to L.A., and we reformed Sin, and that singer was Frank Starr.
Awesome. What a great story, Rick. Well, I think we should bring these two tracks out of the vault that Rick has let us debut on the show today as a world premiere. Rick, I'm going to just do a double shot of both the tracks. Why don't you tell the people a little bit about them, On the Run and I'm No Angel, before we get started and announce it.
Okay. Interesting backstory of On the Run. in the studio. This is while we were in the studio. When Steppenwolf's Born to Be Wild came out, it brought a focal point on three things: hard rock and heavy metal, leather, and motorcycles. And to that point, On the Run was my response, my answer to Born to Be Wild. There's no mistaking that it's a motorcycle song right at its core. Saxon wrote Motorcycle Man, right? So On the Run is my echo ping in answer to Born to Be Wild. Now, Dana and I had fought tooth and nail over how the song is supposed to start at the beginning. I wanted to use the same effect as Montrose's Bad Motor Scooter with the motorcycle revving the gears. He was arguing with me that too many bands have used that effect, you know, just because he wanted to use the keyboard in the Lightning Thunder intro, which you'll hear. It's nice, but it's not what I wanted. Ironically, right after we did it his way, Motley Crue came out with Kickstart My Heart, and how did they intro it? Exactly like Bad Motor Scooter with their motorcycle gears revving.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I was right all along, but Dana wouldn't listen to me. I even considered selling the song to Judas Priest because, as you'll hear, it's perfect for them, but I never got around to it.
Hmm.
So, On the Run was like my answer to Born to Be Wild. It's a motorcycle song, and now that he's gone, as we think of Frank Starr, and I dedicate this to him, I think of Frank on his motorcycle going down the road, because everybody who knows Frank will remember what he was like and can easily picture this in their mind as they hear the song.
All right, very cool. And what about the I'm No Angel?
I'm No Angel was written around 1978, 79 by myself and a guitar player in New York City, a friend of mine named Frankie Derespino, also went by the name of Frankie Desperado. And he hung out with me on the Max's Kansas City scene. I was a real big fan, I still am, of the band Stars. And they had a song called She's Just a Fallen Angel off their first album. Frankie was sitting around one night and he started noodling around and he was playing these interesting little descending patterns. And I said, wait. Put that to here, place that here, place to here. Okay, now play this pattern. And I said, let's record this. I want to work with this, which he did. And I wrote the song, I wrote the lyrics, and it's like my homage, my tribute to Stars. They have a song called She's Just a Fallen Angel. My song is called I'm No Angel. But it kind of has that almost Stars/Kiss feel to it. It's one of the first commercial songs I wrote. And Frank Starr is singing on it. It's a very rare demo out of my collection, and I'm just very proud and privileged to be able to share that with the fans and everybody listening in.
All right, you guys, you heard it from the Fox himself. We're going to do that worldwide premiere. This is a double shot of Sin. We'll be right back after these two tracks talking with the legendary bass player Rick Fox. We'll be right back. All right, all you fans out there, you're tuned in, Hard Rock Radio Live, where the music doesn't suck. Two double shot tracks there from the band Sin, I'm No Angel, and On the Run. And we just did the worldwide premiere of those. On the Run was re-recorded by the Sin album and mastered. Also, the I'm No Angel, it was the Sin demo that Rick produced in 1984 featuring the late Frank Starr. We're talking once again back on air with the legendary bass player Rick Fox, a member of the 80s LA rock scene, also a part of Wasp, Steeler, Sin, Thunderball, and Surgical Steel. I know Rick wanted to add in a little bit more about the tracks here as we get on with the interview. Welcome back, Rick.
Hi.
What's going on? Tell us a little bit more of what you wanted to add in about the tracks that we just debuted.
Okay, On the Run. It's interesting how, when you step back and look at the big picture and connect the dots, how people interface and they leave and then they come back again later at some other point. As I mentioned earlier, when I was at SIR Studios, and I happened to walk into the room that we used to rehearse, and there was Vinnie Vincent standing there in Ace Frehley's Lightning platform boots with a Marshall stack and his guitar playing Ace Frehley. I just heard the Ace Frehley licks coming through the door. I opened up, and there's Vinnie, and he looks up, he goes, "Oh, hi." I said, "Oh, hi, sorry, whoops," you know, shut the door, walk back out.
Yeah.
I figured, well, this must be the new guy they've got. That was my first impression, seeing Vinnie Vincent. He was in Ace Frehley's famous Lightning thigh-high boots. So here we are years later. I get introduced to Dana Strum. I think it was through the manager of a group who I worked for in New York from Baltimore. They were called Face Dancer on Capitol Records. I did lights for them at a club in New York called Great Gildersleeves. The manager was a guy named Bob Ace. Bob introduces me, when he came to L.A., he introduces me to Dana Strum. He says, Dana's been, you know, he's put Randy Rhoads, this is claim to fame, was he put Randy Rhoads in Ozzy Osbourne's band. And then when Randy passed away, he put Jakey Lee in Ozzy Osbourne's band. So Dana kind of had his finger on the pulse of what was going on in Hollywood. He was a mover and shaker and eventually a shark. And by that I mean, I walked into our recording session one night, and Dana's at the control board, and sitting next to him is who? Vinnie Vincent.
Hmm.
Hi, Rick. How you doing? Nice to meet you.
Really?
Yeah, I remember meeting you when you were in Ace's Boots auditioning with Kiss or learning to say. He goes, "Oh, yeah, I remember that. Ha, 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 ha." And he said, "Listen, Dana's been playing me some of the playback mixes from your stuff." He goes, "I really like that song, On the Run." He says, "We'd be interested in possibly maybe working with that song, maybe redoing it or something, and have you be involved."
Really?
And they never defined what be involved meant. And I said, yeah, let me think about it. And nothing ever happened after that. Well, right before his All Systems Go album comes out, Mark Slaughter, who also sang on the Sin demo, let me kind of intersparse this. The singer on that version of On the Run is not Frank Starr. That was a guy from San Diego from a band called Child. His name was Rick Reed. He came in, sang the tracks, and then he wanted to make us his backup band. That's what our management told me. They said there would be a change if Rick joins the band. You would be his backup band. Everybody at the conference table turned around, looked at me, and I didn't bring the band this far to have just handed over to some new guy just because he's got a great voice. Rick Reed's claim to fame was he mimicked Ronnie Dio's voice in the old Budweiser beer commercial, which sounded like Rainbow in the Dark. That was Rick Reed on that commercial. At the time he was singing on our tape, he was driving a Sparklets truck, you know, Sparklets water truck around. That was his job. At any rate, Mark Slaughter came in. Mark sang on our tape. Tommy Thayer, who was then with Black and Blue, Patrick Young, these guys from Black and Blue, they were in on the session. Everybody came in and sang back up and worked on the tape, and I thanked them for that. But Mark Slaughter comes up to me at a NAMM show, the Winter Market Convention out here for music merchants. He says, "Listen, before this gets out of hand, I want to say something to you. I want to apologize because we wound up doing one of your songs on our album, and I didn't know it was your song."
Oh, wow.
Until Dana told me. I said, "Mark, if you sang on the Run and did the tracking parts of it until we got the singer, how could you not know when you hear the hook it's the same song?" He says, "Look, I just want to apologize." He goes, "You know, we didn't have any say in it." And at that point, Bobby Rock, the drummer from Invasion, also apologized. He says, we were not in on this. This was a completely Dana Strum maneuver. Dana took your song On the Run and re-recorded it as a new song, and my publicist at the time, who was publicist for Vinnie Vincent Invasion, when he got out of KISS, was also my publicist, a girl named Charmaine King, gave me the demo tape or advanced copy of Let Freedom Rock, and I played it. And it's the exact same three opening chords as my song Break Down the Walls, and then they go right into the hook of On the Run. Now that everybody has heard this version of On the Run, you play them side by side to Let Freedom Rock, and there is no doubt where Let Freedom Rock came from. Dana Strum took it, re-recorded it, and I threatened him and Chrysalis Records to not release that album or I'm going to sue. What Dana Strum told me on the phone was, you go ahead and sue us. He goes, you can't copyright a hook. I said, what about George Harrison getting in trouble from My Sweet Lord? That was the same riff as He's So Fine. George Harrison got sued and lost. Dana goes, look, take us to court. We'll bleed you dry, every dollar you got, and then we'll countersue you just for being a pain in the ass. He goes, Carmine Appice even told me, give him $1,000 and tell him to shut the heck up. I said, what are you telling Carmine Appice our business for?
Yeah.
And he goes, good, try and sue us, see what happens. Not long after that, again, fate intervened, and Vinny had a lot of financial problems. He had bankruptcy court, and I was one of the debtors that were all listed on there because I wanted my money for him stealing my song. And I sat at Vinny Vincent's bankruptcy hearings, and when my name was brought up, he looked at me, he looked past his lawyer, and he said, whispered something in his lawyer's ear, and the lawyer said, Your Honor, we'd rather talk to you in private chambers about that. And they would not discuss the details about him stealing my song and turning it into Let Freedom Rock. So I know a lot of people have asked me about that, and Vinny's been in the news lately. And again, you're connecting the dots, there's the tie-in again of me and Vinny Vincent via Dana Strum. That's how that whole thing was instrumental. Dana took the song, gave it to Vinny Vincent, behind our back, and they re-recorded it and stole the song. So, yeah. Behind that.
It seems so unfair, Rick. All these ideas that you've had, the bands, you trust these supposedly friends and bandmates of yours, and they're stealing your ideas out there like that. It's good to get that word out about what really happened. I know you wanted to touch base on another cool band that you were a part of called Warlord, and then let's go into a little bit about what's going on about performing with rock legends, the late Ronnie James Dio and Sam Kinison.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to touch on was that a lot of people, mostly the California people, don't know that much about my past as a musician. As I said earlier, playing in the clubs in New York and New Jersey, as well as playing in Arizona as a member of Surgical Steel. But I'd like to mention a lesser-known area of my post-WASP time in Los Angeles. I was referred to by a mutual friend and introduced to these two band leaders of a group known amongst the cult favorites as Warlord. They were a North Hollywood band. They were an extremely heavy band with extremely dark, complex, minor key arrangements in their songs. This was a really learning experience for me to hang on, because I haven't really delved into that kind of music much in the past. More well-known music of that genre, such as Black Sabbath or Blackmore's Rainbow, and artists who specialize in minor key arranged material. So it certainly was a new finger exercise for me. All these years later, I read somewhere that Yngwie Malmsteen said that Warlord was one of his favorite bands. And the whole time it never occurred to me to mention to him that I was a member of that band when we were in Steeler together, because to Yngwie, I was viewed as an inferior player. But then again, virtually everyone except Yngwie is considered by him to be an inferior player, or else he wouldn't be replacing all his side players so often and blaming them for his lack of strong record sales. However, although we rehearsed very often in Warlord, the two band leaders were very adamant about not wanting to ever go out and perform their magnificent material live, and I could never understand that aspect about them. It led to an eventual frustration, and so at some point I met the members of Hellion, and this is when Anne Boleyn was fronting the band, and I began rehearsing with them as well, and Hellion definitely wanted to play out live, so you can see how that would be more of the preferred path to take. The band members were great, they were easy to get along with, and I wound up playing with those band members again years later, connecting the dots, as I said, come full circle, when I joined Burn, when they were managed by who? Ronnie James Dio's Niji Management.
Wow.
So connecting the dots, you can see how and where several times now that Ronnie and his company and I have rubbed shoulders. So there must have been some incredible fate involved in that account. I'd say, given the kindred spirits Ronnie and I had, you know, it was a love and a passion about all things medieval.
Awesome.
It's a mystery why I never pushed to create an opportunity to actually play in Ronnie's band, which is a personal regret, I guess.
Yeah, that would have been awesome, Rick.
But I did get to perform with him twice as a live support for his hearing aid song, We're Stars.
Yeah, remember that.
One of the high points of my career in music, and for which I'm eternally grateful to him for that. As you mentioned, the other being performing live with the late Sam Kinison, which we did a show at the Hollywood's China Club. So I've been blessed with a few things along the way, with opportunities that were considered like the Maltese Falcon, and that is the things that dreams are made of. You know, there's a famous scene at the end of the film Pretty Woman where the street guy is shouting out, "Welcome to Hollywood, everybody's got a dream."
Yeah, I remember that.
What's your dream?
Right.
So, you know, anything that you do outside of your own backyard, and in this case I'm referring to L.A., is or was not well publicized back then, and therefore fell on everyone around you, not having a clue as to what you did or were doing, because it didn't have an effect on them overall unless you did it in L.A. So, having played six nights a week with the E. Walker Band, as I mentioned earlier, or playing in Virgin and Sin opposite bands like Harlow and Twisted Sister, or when I was an aggressor opposite Rachel in the clubs in New Jersey, none of that really meant anything to the club people in L.A. Now, of course, now it seems to matter because everyone is apparently really interested in where you came from, because the Internet is such a powerful tool for sharing that information today, so it makes it really easy. Now, people are going, "Wow, I never knew that about you." Knowing Kiss and the New York Dolls and all the famous bands in the New York rock scene, well, yeah, I was playing and hanging out with them in the same scene right alongside them in many of the same clubs. So the thing that happened with Ronnie is that I was backstage at the Irvine Meadows. It was the Sacred Heart Tour. Here, We're Stars has already been out. And there was a whole bunch of us rockers from Hollywood hanging out backstage, and somebody came running out, started grabbing all of us, going, "Come on, come on, come on, just follow us, come on, come on, come on." And they brought us out through the backstage area. We came out under the castle turrets. I turn around and look up, and there's my buddy Claude Schnell on keyboards up in the turret over Jimmy Bain. And they place us at the microphones, and Ronnie said, "We're going to thank everybody for coming out. We're going to give you a live version of We're Stars," and here we are right now. And we did it live in front of thousands of people. And it was, I mean, it makes your skin crawl to be in front of all those people on stage with Ronnie Dio singing We're Stars.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Any better than that?
I don't think so.
Next weekend, I was at the country club in Reseda for Rough Cut, who was also managed by Wendy Dio.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at their show, and we're hanging out in the VIP balcony. And they one more time, they start grabbing everybody, "Come out on stage, come out on stage, come out on stage." And here comes walking Ronnie, right in, he goes, "Hi, AC, saw me. Hey, remember you from last week? We're going to do another version." And we did We're Stars again. Now we're concentrated. We're packed on a smaller stage. Ronnie comes over, puts his arm around me, grins me close, hugs me close, puts his mic in my face, and he goes, "Sing!" and it was his mic, which had the best mix.
Right.
And I just went out there and went, "We're Stars!" And I heard myself through the whole venue, and I'm like, "Wow, I'm on key, and I'm it's perfect."
Wow. So are you in that video?
No, I'm not. I didn't make the video.
Oh, I was like, I don't remember seeing you in the video, Rick.
I was the only guy who wasn't in that.
Oh, my God. Why didn't you make it to the video?
I think I was busy with Surgical Steel at the moment. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But a lot of my friends were in it, and I had the video of the whole making of. I watched it so many times, so I knew the song.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and so we got to do it twice on stage with Ronnie, and thanks to photographer Dave Plastic, he documented it. He sent me pictures of me and Ronnie, close-up shots, and with Vince Neil and Paul Shortino and Jeff LaBar from Cinderella, all of us on stage together, and that's going in the book. Those are special photos, and then I did the thing with Sam Kinison. There's these. When bands weren't on the road, they would do these little all-star jam get-togethers in the clubs in Hollywood. And my manager at the time was also managing Randy Hansen, who does the Jimi Hendrix show. Well, Sam liked Randy Hansen, and he made Randy Hansen his backup band. That was his, Sam's band was Randy Hansen's band. So I get a call one day, one Sunday afternoon, and it's a, and I guess it was Randy, and he says, "You want to jam with us, Sam Kennison? We're at the China Club. Get your bass, come down here now." I said, "Are you sure I'm going to play? Because I show up at these things, and I just sit around, and I never get to play. You know, Phil Soussan doesn't want to unplug. Jimmy Bain doesn't want to unplug. It's like, you know, are you sure I'm going to play?" He says, "Just come down to the club now." So my roommate at the time, we jumped in his van, we drove to the China Club, and they said, "You want to do the first show or the second show?" I said, "Let's do the second show." So Jimmy Bain played bass with the first show. Second show came, Jimmy gets back up on stage, Sam's getting ready to play, and the friend of mine who was roadieing for Jimmy saw me standing there with the bass. He goes, "Oh my God." He unplugs Jimmy's bass, pushes him off the stage.
Oh my God.
Jimmy's like, "What's going on? What's going on?" And he grabs it, he goes, "Get up there," and he plugs me in, and we're doing Wild Thing.
Wow.
And I'm on stage not only with Sam Kennison, I'm amongst legends of legends.
Are you in that video?
That was the studio version.
Okay.
Live on stage at the China Club.
All right.
Sam Kennison on stage, and I'm shaking now.
Really?
Yeah. And on the stage is Randy Castillo, the late Randy Castillo from Ozzy's band, on drums. Randy Hansen on guitar. The Plasmatics producer, Jean Beauvoir. You know, and he played, he's produced everybody. Jean's on stage playing guitar. Little Steven from Sopranos, Little Stevie, Van Zandt, he's playing guitar.
Wow.
I don't remember, there was a guy playing keyboards, I think, and of all people, from the Roseanne TV show, John Goodman gets up there and he's playing blues harp.
Wow, that's
amazing. And I'm on stage with these guys, and I'm, pinch me, somebody, this is, I'm dreaming.
I bet.
I'm surrounded by some of the biggest stars in the business. You know, and I look over at Randy Castillo, and he's big smile on his face. "Hey, Rick, hey." And we did Wild Thing.
Wow.
I can tell you the room was like diamonds. There was thousands of cameras going off.
Wow.
I don't have one picture.
You don't have one picture from that?
I have a picture of me and Sam downstairs in the dressing room. He hugged me, put his arm around me, and he goes, "Ah," like that to the camera. And I have that picture, but I don't have any live shots of me on stage with him.
Wow, what a great story, Rick.
I contacted Jean Beauvoir through Facebook. He goes, "Yes, I remember that night. I remember you." He says, "I don't have any pictures of that either." And then some guy popped up somewhere and says, "I saw your post. I have some pictures from back then. I have to get them developed. They're not digital." And I said, "Okay, great. Let me know when you get." And I never heard back from the guy.
Wow. What an incredible
story. I'm hoping that somewhere, somehow, whoever has pictures from that night at the China Club will show up and say, "Rick, here's pictures of you and Sam Kennison on stage."
Hey, Rick, one of your fans is asking about the Thunderball videos that you have in your cellar. And then another fan had a Wasp question that I wanted to ask you earlier, but I'm going to ask you it real quick now. If there was a strange twist of fate, this is from Lisanne, and Blackie realized what he'd done wrong to some of his former band members. He apologized to you guys. He did a one-night show and asked for all his ex-members to do that show. Would you do it?
Absolutely.
Really?
Sure, why not?
All right. Where's the Thunderball?
You know, the fans deserve it. The bands rock halfway. It's the fans that make the circle complete. The fans is what makes the bands rock.
Yeah, that's true. And what about the Thunderball videos?
First of all, how do they know if I have a basement or not?
Yeah, well, he said cellar. I don't know. It's Mega Dave.
I think I know who Mega Dave is. Yeah, Dave Sanchez. Shout out to Dave. I think that's him.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah,
Mega Dave 67.
Yes, I have Thunderball video, and I have a Thunderball demo that I produced. The video was shot by a guy named Greg Mastro, and he used to walk around all the clubs, and he would video document a lot of the bands. He's got some really interesting footage. He and I have discussed signing some kind of paperwork where we both will not release it without each other's permission. Because it's his video, he has the master, but it's me as the intellectual property and my material on the tape. I have a copy of it. I know there's one or two people that might have a copy of it. I don't know how they got it. That's what we're trying to figure out. But I plan on releasing it a little at a time, or if I can do a compilation and have some Sin stuff and some Thunderball stuff, and I want to get that out to the fans, you've got to see the live video.
That would be great, Rick.
I don't think it's there anymore. In Hollywood, it's a place called the Coconut Teaser. It's like playing on a postage stamp. That was where we had the original singer for Thunderball, which was a guy named Dale Thompson, who came in from Kentucky. He was in a band called Bride, and we changed his name to Kelly Reno. It kind of fit more with us. He said, no problem. And then we did a Troubadour show with him, and Mark Ferrari was on the bill.
I remember him.
As well as Angora and some other bands. And we went to do the song, which is I'd like people eventually hear, called Gypsy Brandy, and we did that at a sound check. And when Kelly opened his mouth and hit these notes, everybody in the room stopped and turned around and looked at and went, oh my God, where did Rick find this guy? Because finding, you know, premium singers in L.A. is hard. So we imported. We got a guy from out of town. I think we got him through Lucy Forbes. She was one of the booking agents at the country club, and she had a musician's finding service, locator service thing. So we did that, and then we did Gypsy Brandy, which... we used to call it the Whitesnake song because the inspiration for Gypsy Brandy was In the Still of the Night. So Gypsy Brandy sounds like a cross between Whitesnake and Guns N' Roses.
Wow, but that sounded...
Playing that one today. I have to leave something teaser there on the back burner for people to anticipate. But we had to replace Dale with another singer, a friend of mine, who came out from Arizona, who I met when I was in Surgical Steel. His name was Mike Corday. Mike sang with Michelangelo with that project, and he was with a couple other projects as well. He's still out there. We're in touch. And I said, Mike, if I put this new project together, are you interested? He goes, I'm in. Let me know when. And you know, so I know I've got a singer I can back on that. And Mike Corday came in and sang some shows with us at the Troubadour when we did with Randy Hansen. As I said, we had the same manager. It was Kenny Rubin. And Kenny was responsible for all the advertising on the Roxy and the Rainbow, all the posters and artwork out there. So Kenny was also had his fingers on the pulse of what was going on. And we flew Mike out from Arizona. We did some shows. He stayed at my house at the Thunder Ballroom. And we did the show. So Mike is the one who's on more of the video of the Troubadour. He stepped right in, and it was like, without blinking an eye, he nailed all the material perfectly. That's the story on the Thunderball material. We'll get it out there as soon as we can.
All right, sounds great. Also, you have a friend, Charlie from New Jersey, I guess. Remember buying your bass before?
That's probably Charlie Lopez.
He bought your bass before you left California.
That's Charlie, yeah. Hi, Charlie.
Did you sign it, Rick?
I believe I did, yeah.
Awesome. All right, well, we can't wait. Rick just has some amazing stories, and I can't wait till you get that autobiography out, Rick. You need to get really working on that. But we're going to bring everybody up to date. I know after the L.A. metal scene in the 80s and 90s, you started dabbling in acting, and bring us up to the Renaissance pioneering about bringing Polish history to the forefront about some of the stuff that you're doing now.
Good.
You there?
Yeah, it sounds good. Looking forward to it.
All right, so what are you going to be, what did you do in the film industry, and tell me a little bit about the Renaissance pioneering.
I think the very last band I played with in Hollywood was a group called Wise Guys. And I met them through the drummer when he and I were extras on a film. I think Alyssa Milano was in it, and Judd Nelson. Was on it, and during one of the breaks, I was talking, he was another rock and roll looking guy, there was a lot of club people, you know, involved in the extras, and his name was Clay, and he told me about his band, Wise Guys, and I said, well, you know, I wanted to steal Clay for my project, and I wound up compromising, and I played some gigs with Clay, with his band, it was called Wise Guys. This is after Thunderball, and we saw, no pun intended, the writing on the wall, Seattle hit and killed everything. So the arena-type band, the arena look, the separation between fan and band as hero worship and you know idols that you looked up to, that was all over. The bands, the days of Angel and all of that are over. Seattle now. Anybody with a flannel shirt and you know ripped jeans and boots and you know the whole heroin thing became the fad. You know that was the whole depressing Seattle scene took over. I grew out all the layers in my hair. I just kind of went with the flow. I chameleoned myself. I camouflaged. I grew my hair out. I grew facial hair for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked more like Al Jorgensen from Ministry.
I heard that story.
The look of... So I did some gigs with Wise Guys, and then that kind of broke up. And at the time, I was getting involved in the film industry. I started out as a production assistant. I went to school for that, and then I started working as a production assistant on some small stuff. And then I got a call. Somebody called the Production Assistants Association office. We need somebody right now. And they contacted me and said, call these people, see what they... And they needed somebody to do props. Prop master. And I had never done that before, but like a lot of people, you talk your way into something, and then you're like, okay, what do I do now? And this woman was like, she needed somebody yesterday, and I went to their office, a production meeting, and next thing I know, I'm a fledgling, by the seat of my pants, prop master, learning as I go along, and trying to, you know, fit in. So I wound up doing props, and on one of the films I was working on that I was also in, because the director goes, Rick, you want to be in the scene? Put on the outfit. And I was a SWAT cop. The film was called Dilemma. It starred C. Thomas Howell, CT to his friends,
yeah,
and a famous actor now, Latino actor, Danny Trejo. And Danny played a convict in the film. And I got to handcuff him several times. Really nice guy. But while we were on the film, the red-haired kid who was in Children of the Corn, he played one of the characters we had to chase out of this hotel room. So the director says, put on the... And I was a SWAT cop, and we were chasing it. And I got some shots in there and everything. I saw I saw some video footage of it not long ago from the film. And on the film, I met this other guy who was doing weapons. And he was an ex-cop. He was in the Navy in Vietnam on the mud boats, the river boats. And we got to commiserating on the film, and he says, you want to come work for me? And I said, sure. I love working around the weapons. You know, I have the whole military thing and my background, my mind, and I'm really into that. And he says, all right, come work with me. And he would get us on these films. And wherever, any film that had to do with guns and weapons, we were on it. And that's where I learned more about, you know, proper weapon safety handling. And, you know, when you're around people who are cops and military, if you're really smart, you'll start picking up all of the lingo and all of the lexicons and you know, how they talk. And it started to come real easy for me. Right about then, I had also joined, as a volunteer, the California State Military Reserve. So first Saturday of every month, I'm in BDUs, which is battle dress uniform, you know, the camouflage, and I was a corporal in the California State Military Reserve. I was a radio operator. And so this brought me even closer to military. I never served, so in active duty, so this was a way for me to kind of give back in any way that I could. My whole family's been in military. My father was in the Navy in Korea. My uncle was in the Marines in Korea. So it was kind of a way for me to give back, and I was too old to join the service anyway. So I did that. And then, so I'm working on the films with this guy with the guns and the weapons, and I got on the TV series Air America. So I got to work with Lorenzo Lamas and the late Scott Plank, and a whole myriad of stars who were on other shows earlier in their career. And I was doing that, and while that was happening, something caught my interest about Renaissance fairs.
Wow.
So on one of my weekends off, I went to a Renaissance fair here in Los Angeles, in this area, and I went, you know, this looks kind of fun, because I grew up, a lot of sons grew up watching sports with their dad. That's their common ground, is sports. We didn't watch sports. We watched movies. My dad introduced me to classic film from a very early age, so I grew up watching old Republic serials chapters and the cliffhangers, the stuff he watched when he was a kid. So I grew up, you know, falling in love with the Errol Flynn films, Tyrone Power, the swashbuckling films. I fancied myself a swashbuckler. I said, Renaissance fairs, I can come in like an Errol Flynn character, I can do this in my sleep.
Wow.
Like a lot of people who don't know what they want to do when they first get involved in Ren Fairs, pirates, that's real easy. Errol Flynn did pirate films, Captain Blood, The Seahawk, that was easy for me. So I joined a pirate group. I was with them for about a month, and while I was at an event, I got solicited and propositioned by one of the largest Renaissance groups in our area. It was the Royal Spanish Court, and they were representing Spain at the time of King Philip and the Armada. They say, well, you can serve with the pirates or you can rule with the Spanish court. And so I kind of did both, and then I've actually wound up morphing into the Spanish court and allowed me to explore and promote my character more. So I was writing on stage choreographed sword fights. You know, we had kind of a little comedy in it, and
right.
and I was doing sword fighting on stage, theatrical sword fighting. It was just, I had an aptitude for it. It felt natural to me for some reason, and I couldn't explain.
Another life, maybe.
Start looking around going, okay, well, Renaissance fairs. You got Queen Elizabeth and Henry VIII, which we call the Liz and Hank Show. That's the prominent thing because of Hollywood. And you've got Western Europe. You have Spain, Germany. Well, Germany wasn't a country at the time. It was a bunch of states. Spain, France, Italy, the Holy Roman Empire. It's Western Europe. And I said, well, what was Poland doing at this time? I don't see any Polish representation here. I'm sure there's Polish people, but they're not. Nobody's representing Poland. I called my dad in New York. I said, what was Poland doing at the time of the Renaissance? He said, Poland was the largest country, the largest land empire in Europe.
Wow.
Larger than all of the other countries combined, and it had more nobility than all of the other countries combined. I said, tell me more. He starts giving me all this historical information. I said, there's nobody out here representing Poland. He says, well, you need an engraved invitation? So I started to create a Polish persona, and I met a couple other people who were doing Polish personas before me, but I wanted to do something different, and my dad reminded me about when I was a kid, he was building a model of this knight on a horse with wings. I said, what's that? He looks at me and goes, that's your ancestry. What are you talking about? He says, I've been researching our family name and our ancestry. He says, we were represented in our ancestry amongst these guys who dressed like this. That's a winged hussar.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I haven't either.
He says, it was about 3,000 of these guys, 2,000, 3,000 of them, charged down the hill, Kahlenberg Heights, at the Battle of Vienna, and they routed the Ottoman Turks off the field. So I started to research more about that. And at that time in America, there was literally nothing to find, especially in the English language, on winged hussars. So I started scouring. I was new on the Internet. I started scouring as much as I could find and putting together, with the help of somebody, I put together like a web page, and I started putting up all these images I could find. And it wasn't long after I started finding all the images I had. People were copying and pasting them on their own sites. It started to spread. It was like Johnny Appleseed. Everybody now was starting to get into winged hussars because it was so unusual looking.
Right.
So I got the armor, and I built my own wings, and I built everything else, you know, all the horse tack and everything else by hand on my living room floor, my costuming. And I found out through research that I was the first person to officially be recognized as creating and promoting these Polish winged hussars in the United States in history.
Wow. Well, congratulations for that, Rick.
Thank you.
And thank you for...
It wasn't easy.
Well, Rick, I want to thank you for being here with us today. Thank you for taking us down this journey through your life. I really appreciate you being here. And also thank you for debuting those great Sin songs that we debuted today on the show. And I know that you want to probably give some thanks out there to a few of your friends. And you can also leave us with what would you do or what would you like to leave behind for everyone before we get out of here?
There's a couple of things I did want to promote, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, well, I got to give some shout-outs to my friend Dave Sanchez, who does amazing internet detective work in finding obscure material about me or bands that I've been in.
Sanchez.
I wanted to thank Fifi LaRue for having me as a featured guest in his show, jamming with his band at a post-NAMM show concert in 2011. That really kind of kicked off the ball on me getting back and active in the music again. I'm involved helping out L.A. rocker Kelly Raven with his efforts and benefits for the Arkansas flood victims relief. I want to shout out to all of Frank Starr's friends and fans from New York and the Long Island clubs before he was an alien and his old haunts like February's and Blackbeard's. Bands who are still trying to use my band names, one word, don't. You can't. I own the rights to Sin, so don't even think about it. I'm still releasing product. So I've never given up or abandoned my own band name. It's just really good common sense policy not to use a band name that was already established years before you were born or thought of yesterday. So you can get in a lot of trouble doing that. Do your homework. Do your research. You all have the Internet now, so there's no excuse. Do an Internet search before trying to use somebody else's band name. On the things I wanted to promote, I have two books I'm working on in progress. One is The Creation of the Winged Hussars in America, and the other is an autobiography, and a lot of people have been asking me about this. So I just want to say that when it comes out, it's not going to just be about rock and roll, heavy metal, film work, and TV and such. This book is definitely going to be a catharsis. I have to set the story from the roots. People are going to be reading about some really shocking things that happened to me during my childhood. Some are profound yet unexplainable things of the nature of psychic phenomenon.
Wow.
As well as real-world experiences. For example, during the 60s, the church is considered above the law. Today, it's very different. And my book is going to be considered firing a warning shot across the bow of the Catholic Church.
Wow.
I was raised in a Catholic family, and the belief system, which is supposed to give us comfort, often turns out to cause some traumatic and horrible nightmares. The very thing that is supposed to unite us more often divides us. So it's the foundation of most wars since the dawn of time to this day. And when my readers see what kind of trauma that was done to me, I'm telling you, Laura, jaws are going to drop.
My jaws are dropping already.
I can say that all women who are going to read my book will be crying their eyes out,
Oh. And
even the men are going to cringe.
Wow.
So definitely going to be a new scandal. It's going to be rocking the Catholic Church.
More controversy.
And your co-Texan there, Dr. Phil, reads it like he did with Duff McKagan's book. Dr. Phil's going to be going to telling people, he's going to tell his people, get this Rick Fox guy, I want him on my show. We're going to have a field day with this one.
Oh, wow. That would be cool.
Because I was never professionally debriefed.
Mm.
So he's going to want me on a show. And if what, put it this way, if what was done to me back then is done to a child today, the entire school administration would be arrested, and Dr. Phil would be all over them 6 ways from Sunday going, what were you thinking?
Wow.
You know, but conversely, since 2009, my wife and I have become fans of Joel Osteen.
Mm-hmm.
And his kinder, gentler, friendlier approach without the brimstone and guilt.
Right.
So, you know, he's like the Tony Robbins of the theology set, and it's more motivational than Bible Thumper. So
exactly. The way it should be.
I can tell you that if we ever had time to sit down and talk, it would be really interesting. So three things real briefly. I wanted to, again, promote Darren Upton's book, Wasp Sting in the Tail. I'm in that. KISS author Ken Sharp has a book coming out in August of 2012 called Nothing to Lose. It's KISS, the early story. So I'm in that, and some of my pictures, exclusive shots, are going to be in that. And National Public Radio personality Charlie Schroeder has a book coming out called Man of War. It's about his time reenacting different parts of history, and we're going to be featured in a section on that when he joined our group for a day as a guest. As you mentioned, there's the potential Steeler reunion. Also, where I'm lobbying for a Surgical Steel reunion and a release of the Surgical Steel album that I recorded on with Dawkins Mick Brown. At this time, I'm trying to put together a new project based around my songs with a little something thrown in for the Steeler and Wasp fans, too. I have a friend I met during my Surgical Steel days who's quite the guitar player named Sean Adair, and it was his idea to create a new band with the focal point being around me and my songs, so of course I didn't argue. As I said, there's plans eventually to release Sin and Thunderball songs and live performance videos for the fans. I understand there's some kind of Monsters of Rock ship cruise thing going on. It's too bad that they missed out on contacting me to perform. I think a lot of my friends from the other bands are involved, like Keel and Cinderella. It would have been nice to see them and rock out together.
Yeah.
So, let's acknowledge David Sanchez for his faithful and diligent internet work. Lisanne Bond, Chris Chinshak, and John Parks for their recent gracious interviews. All the Wasp fans like Sylvia Grossi, Maria Demonkiss, William Haygood, Mike Silcox, Morgan Van Harding in the Rock and Roll Gangstar clothing, and especially my wife Tara for her skills in managing me now, Jan Polbinski and my late dad, and of course you, Laura, yourself, for making this effort to reach out and make this interview possible. I want everybody to watch out for YouTube and more Sin and Rick Fox material coming out in the future. Now, as you asked, what do I have that I would like to leave people with as I sign off with you? It's a quote from my book, my forthcoming book.
Okay.
And that is, when my time comes to leave this plane of existence with all the tools that I was given to work with, and despite all of my foibles, if I made a positive difference for the good in someone's life, that is, if I know that I've made a positive impact on just one person's life, then I can be at peace in knowing that I left a footprint for someone else to follow, And hopefully they, too, will do the same in my memory and remember what I tried to do for them. That is the reward that pays for itself, and you can take that with you when it's your time to check out. I've always aspired to Ronnie James Dio's outlook on life, and I hope that I, too, would be remembered as a cool guy and a great person who tried to give something back.
All right. Great stuff, Rick. Thanks again for being here. Good luck with all your future endeavors, and please stay in touch with me and hang on just one sec, all right?
Sure, go ahead.
All right, you guys, the one and only, the legendary Rick Fox, bass player from iconic rock bands like Wasp, Steeler, Sin, and Thunderball, Surgical Steel, just to name a few. There's so many out there. Now, if people want to get in contact with you, Rick, where can they go?
Well, I'm in Facebook. So you can look me up on Facebook. I'm all over the place. You know, I've bumped into people over the years and say, what happened to you? How come you're gone? You disappeared. I said, you know, we have the internet now. There's something called a search engine. You Google somebody's name. Go to the search engine, you type in Rick Fox and hit search. And you'll find dozens of pages. I'm not hard to find.
Yeah, he told me that too. But
anybody can pretty much track me down through that.
Well, I couldn't track you down, Rick, but I finally did.
Pat Campbell. We have to thank Pat for
yes, we have to thank Pat. For sure.
My rock and roll brother, Pat Campbell, who hooked us up for this interview.
That's right. All right, you guys, we're getting back to the music. Hard Rock Radio Live, where the music doesn't suck. I'm DJ Lovey Laura. We're talking with the one and only Rick Fox on the station. Here's some more music by Steeler. This is No Way Out.